Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show. I'm Robert Bounds. From tomorrow, Tate Britain plays host to Van Gogh and Britain, a new show about perhaps the world's favourite artist. Van Gogh, he of Starry Night, Sunflowers and Supposed Suicide, is also an artistic archetype, the tortured artist, the madman, the genius. In those latter pictures that we know so well, it's tempting to find psychological meaning in the thickness of the oil on the canvas, fury in the brushstrokes, mental anguish in the self-portraits. With Van Gogh, like few other artists, we really think we know him. So what does this Van Gogh and Britain exhibition do that others haven't? Every institution loves to stage a show of the Dutchman's work because he's such a draw. And I've never seen such a big crowd for the morning press view of an exhibition in London. So what fresh light can be cast on those canvases? Well, in this case, using them sparsely. There are many of Van Gogh's great works here, but plenty of omissions too. Instead, and this is good curating, the Tate staff and guest curators have done what Marvel have been doing with their superheroes for years, getting deeply involved in the origin myth of this artistic Superman. So we get what Britain did for Van Gogh, and then we get what Van Gogh did for Britain. The artist had just turned 20 when he moved to London in 1873, and he drank in a vast array of stimuli from walking and walking around Kent way out east and Uxbridge way out west. He worked at the Goupil Gallery in London and saw a lot of prints, editions, work. He loved visiting the Royal Academy's summer exhibition and the National Gallery and immersed himself in Dickens, Eliot and Bunyan, and these helped hone an acute social conscience too. The money was on him entering the clergy and becoming an urban missionary before a letter from his brother Theo urged him to pick up a pencil and maybe later a brush. Not a bad idea, as it turns out, for the history of art. There is, of course, a lot in Van Gogh and Britain. A lot of work, a lot of meaning to play with, a lot of history and history of art to enjoy and grapple with. Strangely, though, one thing seems clear. As a young, relatively happy, although sensitive young man, Van Gogh was obsessed with the monochrome world of print, charcoal and pencil sketches. And later, after Arles and his time in France, came sadness and mental incapacity, but great colour and light and beauty. The transformations in this show are startling and stunning, and we see much more than Van Gogh, also impressionists such as Pizarro and expressionists like Francis Bacon and David Bomberg. There is a lot in Van Gogh and Britain, and to guide us through the exhibition will be two of its curators, Hattie Spires and Martin Bailey. First, Hattie Spires on building up a picture of Van Gogh from before he even had the idea to become an artist.
Hattie, congratulations also on, just for the press view, attaining a Wembley-like crowd. Initially, it seems like this is like the portrait of an artist before he knew he was one and before he was one. What were some of your cues for putting this show together from before Van Gogh even knew he was a painter?
Well, it's been 72 years, I think, since Tate Britain put on a show about Van Gogh, and we were really interested to learn more about Van Gogh and his time in Britain and the impact that that had on him. So his ideas were circulating and percolating. He was absorbing British culture and literature and art, and he was sort of shunning places like Madame Tussauds and Crystal Palace in favour of the parks and gardens and art galleries. So he was working within a stone's throw of the National Gallery. He was looking at pictures there, and it's just fascinating to see what he was interested in. He was writing about Whistler quite a lot, and Constable. He was obsessed with the Valley Farm, and it's just fascinating to see what was interesting to him at that point as a young man. He had arrived here when he had just turned 20. He had to buy a top hat to feel like he was fitting in. He was walking to work and just lapping up British culture and the sights.
These are things which, I mean, when we look forward, I should say, to what Van Gogh became and how his work looked, especially in the latter stages, it is a very difficult line, or most people would not make that connection. Was that some of the idea behind this show? There have been a lot of Van Gogh shows, not here since 1947, but were you looking for a kind of way into Van Gogh, a sort of fresh approach to Van Gogh? And also as a curator, are you learning quite a lot in uncovering all this early stuff?
Yes, it's absolutely, really, it's been a wonderful show to work on. Almost a child's dream to be able to work on a show like this. But actually reading the letters, you do pick up on these British elements of his time here. You can follow him on his journey when you read the letters. And actually, you continue to read the letters, and throughout his life, he is referring back to the prints, the drawings, the pictures that he saw here, and the life that he saw here. All of the range of life that he saw on the streets in Britain. So he was looking at Doré's illustrations in London, A Pilgrimage, that incredible book by Blanchard Gerald, which has these just incredible engravings in it of life in Kensington Gardens and how it contrasts greatly with the slums of Houndsditch. And actually Van Gogh would go out to the East End and see life as it was on the streets, and looking into the backyards of looking at these images of backyards and over London by rail is a really good example of an engraving which actually peeps over people's backyards and sees the laundry hanging up and the sheer sort of poverty going on. And then that plays out again in works such as The Carpenter's Yard and Laundry, which was a really, really technically accomplished drawing. It's quite an early drawing where he's taking a view, he's looking over into someone's backyard, and I think it was an influence that he picked up here.
And these again are sort of subject matter we don't associate with the Van Gogh of the south of France, but he had I think one of your co-curators described him as a bit of an urban missionary. Tell us about that. He obviously had a great social conscience. Some of the stuff he was reading, some of the art that he was looking at, was concerned with showing life as it was rather than life as pretty as a picture, as it were. That's a relatively unknown part of Van Gogh, at least for most people visiting this show. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, and I think this is something that he picked up in Dickens, the dignity of work. He wanted to be an artist of the people, for the people. And when he moved to London, it was an absolutely teeming city. It was one of the most technologically advanced cities in the world, with over 3 million people here. So it was quite bustling compared to where he was before, in The Hague. And so he really picked up on the people that he was living and working amongst. He wanted to think about them in terms of Dickens. In fact, he said everything that he does is to try and translate into his drawings, into art, what Dickens did with words, he said later on. So it's he's really picking up on these themes about the everyday, people of the everyday, and just being at one with them and trying to really emphasise that dignity of the working people.
And it's a rare thing when you're doing a show on a major artist to not be talking about where they went to art school and the artist fraternity that they hung out with as a young painter and all the rest of it. Here we're seeing someone go from maybe having a career in the church to maybe being, as we said, some sort of urban missionary to someone sort of almost, it seems by the letters, being persuaded by his brother to be an artist. Or, but why don't you try this out? How have you tackled some of those issues and that storyline curatorially here? Because it's a very unusual one.
Yeah, it is an interesting one. Yeah, right. The persuasion of Theo, who was actually at the centre of the Parisian art world. He'd set up a centre for Impressionism, and Vincent's having this dialogue with Theo all the time. And it's really interesting to do this slightly different story. I mean, what a character Vincent was. I mean, he was an intense character, and when you read his letters, you really begin to fall in love with his character, but you realise also from reading some of the words that Theo wrote that he was actually a very difficult person to live with. And so you get this intensity, I think, and we're playing with the intensity here. He'll turn his attention from art dealership to teaching, and then he'll drop that in favour of trying to become an urban missionary or an evangelist, and he'll set his path and just he'll really aim for that and do everything in his power to try and become that thing. And he always had the sense that something was brewing, that he had to do something to be useful in life. He wanted to give a gift to people. It took him a while to work out what that was, but he eventually put down the Bible in favor of a pencil and started drawing after his time in Belgium, when he was looking at miners and their hard work there. And he'd become disillusioned with religion in that way. I don't think he ever really lost the religion, but his
went spirit, off as a job.
Yeah, as a job, yeah. Yes. But the spirit was there, and he puts it into his work. It's fascinating.
And, you know, he was an artist that was very sort of self-mediated. He wrote about how he felt. He obviously had this famous correspondence with his brother, Theo. Does that, from a curatorial standpoint, does that make it easier or harder? Because you're always maybe overlaying what he's saying in his letters with the paintings that he was working on at the time, when maybe you just want to look at the visuals, you want to look at the work itself, rather than knowing too much of what might be mistook as the backstory. I mean, it's a gift when you're putting together a rich show like this, but generally curatorially, can it be a hindrance?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, part of what we're trying to do with the arc of this story in this exhibition is to look at how his life is entangled with his work, and how do we disentangle it? How did British artists cope with the same thing? They're reading the letters, they're keeping copies of the letters under their beds, they're doffing their hats to him in the morning before they start work, they're going to the south of France. A cult of Provence forms between the wars, because they've got the archetype of the artist as this sort of solitary character. They think, oh, we're going to go to the south of France, we're going to live and work like him, we're going to follow literally in his footsteps, we're going to paint what he painted. And actually, that's part of the story of the show. It's how Van Gogh was received by the press, by artists, and how that evolves over the course of the last century. Because as the century darkens, they begin to take on the expressive elements of his brush marks in favor of the color and line. And you can see, as this exhibition culminates with Francis Bacon and David Bomberg, who are really interested in Van Gogh's work.
It's a wonderful opportunity, that final room where we start by sort of seeing Van Gogh lap up British influence, and we see in what sways he gave it back to British artists of the 50s, sort of expressionistic artists of the 1950s. Is that a satisfying journey for you as a curator to go on as well, to kind of move out of the monochrome world of the late 19th century in England and suddenly blast people with some of these big colours?
That's it. Here it is. Here comes the colour. And actually, for a period, Francis Bacon was really working in as though he was in a cave, someone described it as. And then actually after that moment, he comes at us with colour again. And actually some of his contemporaries pick up colour from this series of portraits, and it goes into the British art schools at that moment. So it has this really incredible resonating effect, this ripple effect through the art schools in this country, that splash of colour that comes.
That was Hattie Spires, one of the curators of Van Gogh and Britain. Now, Martin Bailey, a co-curator and author of Starry Night, Van Gogh at the Asylum. And I asked him about the myth of the artist.
We are standing in front of a picture here at the Tate, in front of the Asylum. But I want to go back to the beginning of the show first and talk about Van Gogh in England, which is something that a lot of people may not know about. What was it? I mean, we start off with kind of the colours and textures that we don't know Van Gogh for, sort of dun-coloured landscapes, lots of clouds, lots of things that we're not necessarily familiar with when we think of Van Gogh. Can you tell us a little bit about his early time in England and what inspiration he found here under slightly different conditions to Arles and the south of France with which we're familiar?
Yes, it's two different worlds entirely. I mean, Vincent was 20 when he came to England, which is an impressionable age for any of us. And it was a huge city. He explored London, he enjoyed the sights. He nearly went to Madame Tussauds, although in the end he decided he was more interested in the museums. But the most important thing about his period in England was that he was working for an art dealer It's difficult to imagine him, Vincent, as an art dealer, and he wasn't very good at it, but it did mean that he discovered art, and he saw an enormous amount of reproductions which the gallery sold, very good high-quality reproductions and paintings. So I would say that if he had not come to England as an art dealer, if he hadn't worked as an art dealer, he would never have become an artist. And then once he was here, he imbibed English or British culture. He enjoyed reading English literature. He read nearly all of Dickens. He read Shakespeare, which most of us today would find difficult to read, let alone if you had a foreign language. And he discovered English art. And most importantly, he became interested in the English illustrators who worked for magazines like the Illustrated London News and the Graphic. So it was a very formative period for him.
And one of the things that jumps out as an unusual thing, again, in our sort of common understanding of Van Gogh, which is his love of black and white, his kind of jumping headfirst into the monochrome world of these artists that would have worked for the London Evening, the Illustrated Evening News and things like that. Where on earth do we trace the line from that early black and white monochrome loving Van Gogh to the crazy colour of the later years?
Well, Van Gogh was self-taught. Although he later went to art college for a few months, it never actually worked. So he was self-taught and he did exercises at home, drawing exercises. And he started off doing drawing, not watercolours or oil paintings. And when he was doing drawing, he was very inspired by the English illustrators who worked for these papers. And it was actually several years after he left England that he fell in love with them. But he knew their work originally from when he was working in London. So I think that's what made him go back to them. And that really provided the inspiration, and it provided some technical guidance as to how one drew things. So that was very influential in the early years of when he was an artist, in the early 1880s, when he was working mainly in The Hague. I mean, later on it became much less important, but it was very important at a formative stage once he decided that he wanted to become an artist. And he said he wanted to take up his pencil, that's the way he put it when he decided to become an artist. And his pencil, he said, began to behave itself.
Which is handy for seeing how these later works turned out as well. Yeah. One of the things, a preoccupation of his, supposedly in the early days as well, when he was in England, was a kind of obsession with the itinerant as well. He was a Dutchman in England, but he was interested in sort of lonely figures on the road and windswept landscapes. But there was something of, maybe we're trying to trace too far the idea of the tortured artist in those early years, but there seemed to be a lot of singular people looking a bit morose in a windswept landscape. Where did that come from, if that was a thing with him?
I think it's actually difficult to look
at... We're transposing meaning upon paintings.
I think so, yes. He had periods of loneliness. He was, as you say, he was travelling all the time. He worked in different cities. It was quite unusual in those days to travel as much as he did. And he ended up living in, I think, something like 20 different places. He was never anywhere for very long. So he was always a lonely figure, and if you like, a lonely figure on the road. Yeah. But I think there's a danger in looking at his art and the story and then trying to see that too closely mirrored in the pictures. And he put people in the pictures because they give life to a painting if you're doing a landscape or a landscape drawing. And he was certainly interested in that, yes.
And that's the thing. Some of the descriptions, I suppose they were some of the wall text lifted from the 1948 exhibition, which was the last time he was shown here at Tate, was like tortured for some of the brush strokes and things like that. Is that an unfashionable way to look at an artist like Van Gogh nowadays?
Well, I personally, we all have our own ways of looking at art. I personally don't look at it in terms of torture. I try and look at it as art.
Yeah.
And I do think it's difficult to interpret why someone is using brush strokes. I think he was much more interested in the visual effect, and I think that was in his mind. He had a fantastic visual memory and a visual sense, and he was very ambitious, and he wasn't afraid of doing something unusual. So he would use thick impasto paint, which was unusual in those times, to convey what he wanted to convey. I mean, you're quite right, he was an emotional person. He was probably a difficult person to live with or even be friends with. He wasn't easy, and he had depths, and he became obsessed with his art. But if he hadn't become obsessed, he never would have created the wonderful works that are surrounding us down in the basement of the Tate, in the galleries here.
And to take the title of your book, Martin, Starry Night, Van Gogh at the Asylum, we're standing in front of one of those pictures that presumably was a source material for your book.
Yeah.
He was quite, I mean, for the day, I'd have thought quite rare in self-diagnosing himself and putting himself into these places, right?
Yes, I'm not sure he would have actually thought he was putting himself into it. I mean, what he's done in this painting, and it's...
Keep dragging and screaming.
It's a marvellous painting. It's actually the garden of the asylum, and it's the one place that he could escape to from the other patients. There were actually only 18 male patients, so there weren't many. But it must have been a terrible environment. There were many who were screaming, who were shouting, who were breaking furniture and that sort of thing. And the garden offered him a means of escape. And he went out there, and he loved nature, and he was very aware of the changing seasons. So he would paint in the garden. And what's astonishing about the painting here of this island garden is the way the trees just sort of grow up above the building. The building looks tiny, and he's looking up at the sky. I mean, it's almost as if on a summer's day, you and I were lying on the grass, sort of looking up at the clouds and sort of relaxing and dreaming. And I think it offered Vincent a way of escaping from the indignities of living in an asylum.
And again, if we go back to some of those sort of, if we again sort of paint our own version of him over his pictures, there seems to be great lightness and life, and the thick paint and the vivid colours in a painting like this don't at least suggest kind of the idea of the tortured, perhaps.
No, I mean, most of the artwork he did was the artwork of a sane person. It's often said, oh, the brushstrokes show that he was tortured or mentally upset. But he painted when he was relatively well, and this is a very good example, and it's so vibrant. I mean, what I love about it is the colours of the sky and the way that they change, and the way that the trees are almost alive. You could almost feel the trees moving, and he obviously observed the trees. He knew what they did. He spent hours and hours looking at this garden, and you can see the way he really loved and appreciated nature. Nature was so important to him.
At what point, generally, do we start getting these colours? As I say, we come out of Van Gogh in England, and an appreciation for some of that monochrome world, that industrial world. He goes to Arles and he sets up a kind of artist community and things like that. Where does this sudden rush of colour and vividness come from?
Basically, when he leaves his home country of the Netherlands, when he was working in Holland and the Netherlands, he used dark colours, which was the colours that were used by most Dutch artists at the time. He then went to Antwerp for a few months, only sort of 4 or 5 months, and he began to see other artists using bright colours. Then, most importantly, he went to Paris, where he discovered the Impressionists, and they gave him a confidence to use colour. And he did a lot of paintings of still lives of flowers. Again, they were sort of exercises for him in the use of colour. Then he decided to go to Provence, and he was so struck by the bright and powerful light in the south of France, and he sort of, that inspired him to use even more dramatic colours. And possibly the most striking colours are when he was working for 1 week at the Mediterranean, and he saw the Mediterranean beach under the powerful southern sun. So it was in the south of France and Provence that he really discovered colour, and in a way that was his great contribution.
And just finally, we talked about perhaps being writers and overlaying our sort of desire to adjectivise his work, yeah, you know, tortured and all the rest of it. Has that helped with understanding Van Gogh, or has it sort of hindered our understanding of Van Gogh, do you think? Well, I kind of need always to put him into this tortured box.
I mean, Van Gogh must be possibly the most popular artist internationally. I mean, possibly along with Picasso, but he must be. And I think the reasons are twofold. First of all, his art is so inventive and appeals to us well over a century later. But we're also interested in his story and the story of his life. And it was an extraordinary story, the number of incidents and the things that happened to him. And we're very fortunate that we have so many of the letters that he wrote, mostly to his brother. So we actually have the words of how he felt on a particular day. So people are very interested in the biography, and that gives an added dimension. And in a positive sense, it helps people understand what he's created. As you say, it also encourages myths, and there are some things which hinder our development. But I think it's a very strong factor of why we will be getting an awful lot of people coming to see the Tate exhibition.
We think we know him.
Yes. No, there's always more to discover.
Aha. Says the writer of books on Van Gogh. We must read. Martin, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Okay.
And that brings us to the end of our show about the exhibition Van Gogh and Britain. It's at Tate Britain until the 11th of August, and it's wonderful. Did we mention that? While you're there, go and see Mike Nelson's The Asset Strippers up in the Devine Gallery. It's also amazing and strangely moving. And that is on until the 11th of October. Thanks to all at Tate Britain, and of course to this programme's wonderful producer, Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in.